Hey, today's program is sponsored by SunsetLakeZebedee.com. We're doing something special with SunsetLakeZebedee.com. Sunset Lake Zebedee and the Majority Report are teaming up to turn America's most consumerist holiday. I guess we just had Black Friday and Cyber Monday, although today is Giving Tuesday. I don't know why we got to do this, but all those different days. But the bottom line is, with Sunset Lake Zebedee, we are doing a we're creating a fundraising opportunity for a great organization, and here's how it works. If you visit sunsetlakezebedee.com until tomorrow, this ends tomorrow night, December 1st at 11:59 p.m. Everything, you don't need a coupon code, everything is 30 to 60% off. And then if you order over $100 worth of stuff, you will receive a free jar of their delicious Zebedee gummies. It's a $40 value, and it's for free. This is a great time to go load up on all of your Zebedee goodies. The fudge, the coffee, the Arnica and Zebedee rubs, the hand lotion, the tinctures with melatonin, the smokables, the keef, all of it. Now is the time to do it. No promo code needed. Products are already discounted on the website. You know how much I love this company and this product. They have been incredibly supportive of the show, but they've also, almost more importantly to me, they've allowed me to sleep without having to take Ambien, which has been a big deal for me. Sunset Lake Zebedee will donate 10% of the sales up until tomorrow night. They've been going on for almost 8 days now to givedirectly.org. This is an international anti-poverty organization that sends cash directly to those in need in extreme poverty and allows themselves to choose how to spend that money with dignity in a way that best suits their lives and their needs. You've heard me talk about Give Directly in the past, and Sunset Lake was like, where do you want to earmark this to? Give Directly was my choice based upon just all the data we've seen in terms of how much giving directly just simply makes sense. Majority Report is going to match that 10% donation. So head over there, buy some Zebedee, and know that 10% of what you're doing plus another 10%, so really 20% of your purchase ultimately, is going to go to givedirectly.org. Sunset Lake Zebedee is a majority employee-owned business. They've donated more than $16,000 this year to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, to union strike funds, nature conservation, food pantries, and refugee resettlement organizations. Again, visit sunsetlakezebedee.com. Take advantage of these discounts and help the Majority Report raise money for a great organization. Remember, sale ends December 1st. That is Wednesday.
Tomorrow
at 11:59 p.m. Also, don't forget, Majority Live is where you get tickets for our Boston show. Fair warning, folks. I think we're done with the mezzanine. They've already started to sell balcony seats. I don't know if it was because of the announcement that John Benjamin and Larry Murphy are going to be there, but that may have done it. We're going to have more guests.
Balcony seats? That's a big crowd.
It's going to be a big crowd. It's going to be a big crowd. Get there right now, majoritylive.com. Don't miss out. This thing actually looks like we're going to get very close to selling out soon. Majoritylive.com. All right. Speaking of Majority Live, let's start this show.
Which is live.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, November 30th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Wengrow, professor of comparative archaeology at University College London and co-author of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, written, co-written with the late David Graeber. Also on the program today, U.S. braces for Omicron. CDC strengthens their booster recommendation. It appears that 16 and 17-year-olds may be eligible within a week. A Trump-appointed federal judge halts the vaccine mandate for healthcare workers in 10 Republican-led states. Joe Manchin, remember him? Now saying, you ready for this? The new COVID variant is giving him reason to pause over the Build Back Better bill.
Dog ate his homework.
New documents show that Chris Cuomo was deeply involved in disgraced brothers Governor Cuomo's public defense. CNN, the ball is in your court. National Labor Relations Board orders a new election at the Bessemer Amazon plant in Alabama. Not sure that it's going to go any better than the first time, but at least it sets down a marker for what these companies can do to sway a vote. Trump's appeal of the January 6th evidence release to be heard today in the U.S. Circuit Court. New York City opens two clean needle sites for the first time ever. Nine Democratic congresspeople call for Steve Donziger's release from jail as he enters his second month of confinement for contempt in a case involving Chevron Oil. And lastly, Barbados dumps the Queen, becomes a republic. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. Happy Tuesday.
Thank you very much. Mm. You're looking very fall.
Yeah. I mean,
wintery, almost.
I was going to say, this is my, we don't have Stitch Fix on today, but this is my Stitch Fix sweater.
Mm.
Yeah.
I like it.
I should have coordinated, but I, you know, you kind of take the lead on the ads anyway.
Yeah.
I'm getting preemptive stage fright about the live show.
It's a little bit early for that, but it's certainly preemptive. But yeah, okay, this is going to be a long, 45 days for you.
I feel like maybe if I kind of stretch out the dosage of the stage fright, that on the night, maybe it won't be so bad.
You're going to amateurize the stage fright on the Majority Live show, right? January 16th in Boston.
Hope it's like, not compounding.
Yeah, it's like when you take a little bit of arsenic with your breakfast every morning. I'm saying this from Succession, in order to make sure that you have some way to stave off poison if you're poisoned.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting way of looking forward to that evening.
But no, I'm excited. It's just when
tickets.
You said balcony seats, I'm like, oh, there's two tiers or there's multiple tiers, and like a lot of people are going to be looking at me.
Three, actually.
Sorry?
I think there might be three. I think we already did like the floor and
cool.
Then the mezzanine. I don't know how it works. But folks, you can get your tickets over at majoritylive.com. Also, let me just get this out of the way. Yes. I have brought back the sweater vest. I think last year I did not wear one through winter.
Why?
I don't know why. I can't remember. Maybe I did.
Didn't feel right.
It didn't feel right. But it's back. It's here. If you have suggestions for where I can get sweater vests, because these are old, they're getting a little bit, little bit beat up, I noticed today. Let me know, because it's hard to find a sweater vest now.
You've got a trunk and a attic somewhere,
more or less.
You wore it out of protest until CNN got rid of Rick Santorum, right?
No. Rick Santorum had nothing to do with it. He usurped my usage of the sweater vest.
Understood.
One other thing, house cleaning note. We are getting towards our annual best of week that is at the end of December. If you have a suggestion for a best of interview that we did this year, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in the subject line best of. And we will tally up the results and may or may not actually take your suggestions. So there it is. get on that. In the meantime, more and more, it is looking like this winter is going to be, in some respects, dominated by Omicron. I was just listening to New York has declared a state of emergency, which allows essentially funds to be diverted. It sounds a little bit more extreme than it actually is, but the numbers are going up. We still have it. We have a state that is, you know, more than 2/3 vaccinated, but it's a big state. And to have a third of people unvaccinated, more than 3/4 vaccinated, to have, 25% of the population unvaccinated, it's creating problems. Just in, I think it's Ulster County, which is right up the Hudson River, not, you know, between here and Albany. The number of hospitalized people, and we're talking, you know, tens of people, not hundreds, because it's small county, but it's quadrupled over the past month.
Yeah.
And it's cold. People are going inside. People are, you know, they're not wearing masks in the way that they used to. For all we know, Omicron is already here, but it's hard to say. And so this is going to become, I think, more of an issue. Here is a Joe Biden press conference. And I think in many respects, they're still wrestling with like how you approach this. I was listening to an interview of a county supervisor in Ulster County this morning. Don't ask me why. And he's like, I don't know if I can, if I'm going to do the mandate, the indoor masks. And the only reason why he's even contemplating not doing it is because there are morons in this country that when they hear mandate of masks, that makes them wear masks less and they make an issue of it. And then they becomes, so he's like, I'm trying to figure out. I mean, this is the,
it's like dealing with a child, right? Make a rule and they'll be more likely to rebel against it.
Yes. And look, this is, you know, people are as people are, but this is the challenge of public health policy. It is not simply the science says you should wear masks, so we're going to mandate masks. The science says masks help. There's arguments as to they help reduce transmission by 10%, or is it 40%, or is it 50%? How much do the different quality masks implicate? But the bottom line is it's greater than zero in terms of its efficacy. And so you want anything that will be an obstacle to transmission. But then the question is like, how do you get people to wear masks? And so, but here is Joe Biden talking about the administration's strategy in dealing with COVID.
Yeah, no, I'm not an Alex, but I'd love to ask one question. And the other
Wait,
Alex.
Both ask questions?
Okay, yeah. I'm going to ask the other Alex and then you.
Sure. Mr. President, is this the new normal that Americans should expect, anticipating future potential variants? Should we expect intermittent travel restrictions and potential drops in the stock market going forward? Do you have any words of reassurance that this won't become the new normal? And then for both you and Dr. Fauci, Dr. Fauci said earlier on CBS that lockdowns, shutdowns are off the table for restraining COVID going forward. You said that won't be part of your plan on Thursday. But why is that? Why are you taking that off the table?
Well, to answer your first question first, the answer is I expect this not to be the new normal. I expect the new normal to be everyone ends up getting vaccinated in the booster shot, so we reduce the number of people who aren't protected to such a low degree that we're not seeing the spread of these viruses. Now, we remain to be seen exactly what the elements of this particular strain are, but if they're as I hope, then it's not going to be fundamentally different than in the past. In terms of what was the second part of the question?
Are lockdowns off the table?
Yes, for now. Yes.
Why is that?
Well, because we're able to, if people are vaccinated and wear their mask, there's no need for the lockdown.
Yes, so
my last question.
Yes, going on from that question, we've got the Christmas period coming up, huge amount of travel. Would you give any thought to domestic flights requiring test or vaccine before people get on planes the same way as they do for international flights?
Well, at this point, that's not been recommended. I would wait for the scientific community to give me a recommendation on that.
Are travel restrictions too late to be effective, sir, given that Dr. Fauci says this new variant could already be here?
You understand the point of the travel, of the restriction, to give us time to get people to get protection, to be vaccinated and get the booster. That's the reason for it. Thank you also very much.
I mean, that's the bottom line. And I think there's a legitimate argument that these travel restrictions unfairly target places that desperately need help in terms of economic help. But they're only just trying to buy a couple, like literally a couple of days. And I think they probably already know that it's here. It's just a question of, and there's probably already community spread, but just like how many different community spreads do you want to seed at any point? That's really what it comes down to. But the bottom line is you get these rulings from, you know, a Trump appointed lawyer to hold off on the vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. On some level, you're trying to stop a leaky dam with, I don't know, with like a sieve.
A Band-Aid.
Yeah, a Band-Aid or a sieve, for that matter. So that's the situation.
Great question about the stock market, though, right? Important question.
But it's also just sort of like...
What is he going to say? What's he going
to... We've decided to mandate that the stock market stay high.
He's like, oh, I forgot to push the big red button that keeps the stock market booming. My bad.
By the way, talk about
this one point about vaccines. New York City had zero COVID-related deaths yesterday, over 90% vaccination. And like, that's because it's basically impossible to live your life in the city right now when you're not vaccinated. You have to show a vax card anywhere you go.
Yep.
So like, just more evidence to show these things work.
All right. Couple of sponsors of the program today. If you're a business owner, it can be tough to hire a top talent for your team. Don't I know it? Especially when you're competing with other businesses to find the right people. So how do you get the hiring edge? ZipRecruiter.com. They have an invite to apply feature that lets you, as the employer, invite the best candidates to apply for your open positions. And now you can try for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, you start getting the most qualified people sent to you very quickly. Then you can easily review recommended candidates, invite your top choices, ask them to apply with only one click. Apparently, next key marketing manager, Erin Hartje, she loves the invite to apply. I haven't talked to her directly about this, but that's what I am told. She says they get my job posting in front of the right people. That's basically what happened when we got Brendan on the program. And then Bradley came from Brendan. That's the way it works. According to ZipRecruiter internal data, on average for 2020, jobs where employers use ZipRecruiter's invite to apply get 2.5 times more candidates. Take it from Aaron, or you could take it from me. But Aaron says you can basically tell ZipRecruiter who you need, when you need it, and they deliver. I would have said the same thing. Yeah. Hey, see for yourself. Just go to this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. And lastly, if you're looking for opportunities to skip the trip to the post office, dodge all that hectic holiday shopping traffic, well, you can save time and money with Stamps.com. Stamps.com lets you compare rates, print labels, access exclusive discounts on UPS and U.S. Postal Service services all year long. Look, it just makes sense, especially if your business sends more mail and packages during the holidays. Doesn't matter whether you're selling online or you're running an office or any type of like side hustle, sending out DVDs like I did back in the day to members. I ran out. Stamps.com can save you so much time and money and stress during the holidays, and God knows we need less stress. Access all the post office and UPS shipping services you need without taking the trip, and you get discounts. And you get discounts you can't find anywhere else. It's like up to 40% off of U.S. Postal Service rates and 76% off of UPS rates. And if you spend more than a few minutes a week dealing with the mail and shipping, Stamps.com is a lifesaver. You can do this 24/7, 365. Just get on your computer. It makes it just much easier. Save time and money this holiday season with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code MajorityReport for a special offer that includes a four-week trial, free postage, and, you ready for this? A digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, enter code MajorityReport. That is code MajorityReport. Okay, I want to welcome to the program David Wengrow. He is a professor of comparative archaeology at the University College London. He is the co-author of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, with the late David Graeber. David, it's a real pleasure to have you on the program. We had David Graeber on at least two or three times over the years, and I found particularly debt for me was incredibly enlightening, and it's a real pleasure to have you here. This book, obviously published, you guys had just about finished it, is my understanding, and published posthumously after David Graeber passed. But welcome to the show. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Thanks so much. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Okay, so let's start. This is I was talking to Matt before the show, saying this is tough. This is tough stuff because it's, you've got three like sort of major academic sort of silos here: archaeology, anthropology, and intellectual history that has, and there's a different mix, I guess, that has developed an accepted, for the most part, worldview as to how humans have developed and developed our societies. So, and so I'm going to ask you maybe to be a little bit remedial for our sake, but walk us through what the prevailing story has been of the development of human society.
We're talking about what's often called the broad sweep of human history, right? And our current picture of the broad sweep of human history was invented long before my discipline of archaeology even really existed, let alone the discipline of anthropology. You can find it, you can find the germ of it in things that were written over 200 years ago, even over 300 years ago, in the writings of philosophers like Thomas Hobbes in England and Jean-Jacques Rousseau in France, who were what were called at the time state of nature theorists, which means that they allowed themselves to speculate on what we were like, what our species was like in its original form. You know, what was that kind of original protoplasmic mass of humanity really like? What kind of, did they have religion? Did they have marriage customs? It was pure speculation, and they were very open about the fact that it was speculative. And these stories which they told were in many ways parables for their own time. You know, Hobbes was living in a time of great conflict, the English Civil War. He told a story about how humanity was originally just like that, a state of war of all against all. And it was part of the way that he reasoned out a justification for the creation of states and strong kingdoms as a way of limiting violence. Rousseau told a different story a few decades before the French Revolution. He told a story about how humanity before civilization was a society of equals. And in that society of equals, people were happy. They were also kind of innocent. They didn't have very much yet in terms of material goods or technical knowledge. And then something happened to change all that. People started planting crops, and from crops came the principle of private property. That's a mouthful. And from that comes territoriality. Populations grow. We get cities, kingdoms, and empires. And eventually we end up with this very familiar story of civilization, which is kind of an ambivalent tale. On the one hand, things get better. We get progress. We get agriculture. We get metallurgy. We get the arts and sciences and philosophy. But with every advance, we fall backwards in the domain of human freedoms and equality. So for Rousseau, we start equal. But with every new invention, with every step forwards, we become more trapped in our chains, as he puts it. So it's all a story which illustrates his famous point. You know, man is born free, but everywhere we find him in chains. And these two stories have had an extraordinary effect on the thinking of serious scholars right down to the present day. They've commanded the attention of social scientists, philosophers, people in my own field who have a huge amount of knowledge and scientific facts at their disposal. But when they go after that holy grail, you know, they try to capture that broad sweep of human history. What we notice, David and I, is that they sort of slip back into these structures of thought, which go all the way back to Hobbes and Rousseau. So we're dealing here with some really powerful, tenacious, we would say, myths.
Can I just want to tease out that structure of thought with Hobbes and Rousseau, and almost like a take a 30,000 foot view of what they're saying, because they're ostensibly at odds with each other on some level, but they're almost like the two sides of one coin in that they have a modality of progression that they are both espousing that is similar. Can you just speak on that so that we understand how, once you buy whichever side of that coin you buy, you're sort of falling into the same, you've already then limited.
You end up roughly in the same place, which is in a place where hierarchy and domination are the inevitable effect of societies getting larger and more complex. It's just that with Hobbes, you start off with sort of chaos and anarchy in his sense, and then you need those hierarchical structures to control it, to kind of tame those disruptive, competitive base instincts. With Rousseau, you get to the same end point, but you just start from the other end of the spectrum. So you start in happiness and innocence, but it's actually the process of societies forming and a complex division of labor and technology that is paradoxically what is supposed to trap us in our chains. But either way, you end up in chains.
And they're both a story of inevitability on some level as a function of human nature.
Yeah, they both start with what is conceptualized as a single fixed human condition, and then something changes, and we're set on a kind of linear path towards roughly where we are now.
And so, and I guess the project of the a new history of humanity is to attempt to impose, to not use Rousseau and Hobbes as a primary assumption and then work from there, but instead to use evidence that we found, archaeological and arguably anthropological evidence, to reevaluate that story.
Well, thinking back, it was actually a messier process because our original intention was to feed into those debates. I mean, the Rousseau's story was actually the answer to an essay competition set by a French academy in the town of Dijon in 1753. And that was really one of the first times that people posed the question, what is the origin of social inequality in human societies? And is it a natural, is it authorized by nature? Is it a natural condition? And people are still asking that question. And when David and I started working on this project, we saw ourselves as contributing to that ongoing discussion. But in the process, we came to realize that the question is a kind of trap, and we found ourselves falling into it. Because by even framing the big questions of human history that way, in terms of origins, what is the origin of inequality? What is the origin of private property? What is the origin of the state? You're automatically sort of back in that kind of linear mode of thought, where once upon a time we assume there was something else, something before inequality, and then something changed, so you get inequality. It already fixes you in a certain way of thinking, which actually wasn't working. I mean, it wasn't matching the evidence that we see in our own fields today from all these modern investigations. So we actually had to do something else. We had to actually start questioning the origins of the question about the origins of inequality in order to even conceptualize the kind of material that we now have at our disposal.
And that brought you to the indigenous critique. And explain to us the argument, as I understand it, is that what we know as the European Enlightenment, and we're talking about sort of a big change in the I guess the the understanding of the world in many respects that took place in the 1600s and 1700s in intellectual thought was
18th century
was a function in many respects of what French missionaries learned from indigenous people.
Well, we're not saying that the entirety of the Enlightenment started there, but there are some very fundamental Enlightenment concepts, really mainly revolving around ideas about freedoms, social freedoms, and equality, which we do argue that the way those ideas developed in European intellectual circles was profoundly influenced by the colonial encounter between mainly French colonists and the indigenous peoples of what's now the Great Lakes region of Canada, sort of down to upstate New York and over to Newfoundland. And this is a story which we tell in one of the early chapters of the book. We knew it would be a provocative story. We say so in the book. But we're not the first ones to tell it, and we stand by it.
Will you just give us a little teaser on that story?
Yeah, I mean, it mainly involves these two characters. Okay, so what we need to establish is that around that time, the early 18th century, there is a genre of literature which becomes incredibly popular in Europe. It's often referred to as savage dialogues, and it generally involves a European author and an exotic interlocutor who is often a completely sort of fancy character. It might be a Peruvian princess or a Persian or a Tahitian or whatever it may be. And most of the major Enlightenment thinkers, particularly in France, Voltaire, Diderot, and the rest, wrote these kind of dialogues. And in them, the exotic interlocutor usually gives a critique of European behavior, of European civilization. There is a text which we know inspired a lot of these kind of savage dialogues, which was written by somebody who actually had been to the French colonies and spent many years there. He went around by the name of the Baron Larentin, and in 1703, he published his Curious Dialogues with a Wise Savage, which features a character called Adario, who historians generally accept is based on a real person, a member of the Huron-Wendat nation, very prominent member of that nation, who was called Kandiaronk. He was one of the signatories of the Great Peace of Montreal in 1701, and he was famous in the region as a warrior and a diplomat, but also as a brilliant speaker and just an extremely smart person. The French governor at the time, a man by the name of Frontignac, would invite Kandiaronk to his table to entertain his officers by engaging him in these debates. So we're not talking here about Disney's Pocahontas, right? We're talking about two people whose lives we know about, who met each other, and who had one of many thousands of interactions that were going on at the time between European colonists and Native American peoples. But the standard way of looking at these dialogues in European history is to say they're completely invented, totally fictitious. It's a dialogue between a European and himself, with the exotic interlocutor is like a sock puppet, like a Muppet, through which the European speaks back at himself and says naughty things about his own society that might get him into trouble. You get the picture. That's the standard way of looking at all of these dialogues, including Larentin's. In that early chapter, we question this. We look at other accounts by Jesuit missionaries who were actually very hostile to many of these indigenous nations. They were critical. They were trying to convert them to Christianity. And we show how many of the words that Larentin puts in the mouth of Adario are actually very consistent with the way that Wendat societies were organized at the time, and also very consistent with the observations that a whole range of Iroquoian and Algonquin and Montanese Naskapi peoples had of Europeans at the time. They thought we were obsessed with money. They were a bit puzzled by our love of hierarchy and the fact that we have kings and bow down to each other all the time, but at the same time that we're very competitive with each other and we'll let our own people fall through the cracks. You know, they were quite scandalized by things like homelessness, which they saw a lot of in colonial towns. Some of them came to Europe. It's quite likely that Kandiyarank himself came to Paris, although we can't quite establish that. So you may be wondering why this is all so central to the book, but it did become really central to the way that we could reconceptualize that whole question. What began as the origins of inequality was originally a dialogue about freedom.
And the idea being that there were concepts that were introduced to Europe that heretofore had been attributed to Europeans themselves.
I mean, it's more than concepts because, you know, the concepts were already there. You can probably find them in a whole bunch of stories from ancient Greece or even in the Bible. They were there as ideas, but they were just one set of ideas among a whole bunch of others. But what was different about that colonial counter is that Europeans, for the first time, actually encountered whole societies that were constructed on some of these principles. You know, they didn't have prisons and judges, but their crime rates were actually lower than in France at the time. So this was a concrete example, you know, a model. They had women's rights that were way ahead of those in Europe at the time. Women could get divorced. There were sexual freedoms that were unheard of. So it's much more of a shock than just reading something in a book. You know, these people are real.
And so what are the implications? I mean, if it is the case that these ideas were and practices really pre-existed, at least in terms of the way the European thought did. I mean, it undercuts, obviously, the idea that Rousseau had and that Hobbes had.
Interesting. It does the opposite. It almost creates those ideas. This is a little involved, but let me try and explain how we explain it in the book. These models of freedom, of an alternative way of living, were gaining ground in Europe at that time. Remember, we are just a few decades away from the French Revolution. And they're gaining ground in intellectual circles where there are thinkers of different stripes. Some are more conservative than others. One of these thinkers is the economist, Henri-Robert Turgot, who, along with Adam Smith in Scotland, really invented the basis of that whole story that we're all familiar with now, where you tell the human story in terms of hunter-gatherers, farmers, and then urban, commercial, industrial. In other words, modes of production or modes of livelihood is the basic way of organizing and structuring human history. But where does that whole idea come from? We actually have a fascinating set of correspondences between Turgot and a French novelist, a woman called Madame Graffini, who wrote the Letters from a Peruvian Woman, where she takes many of the sentiments to be found in La Hontan's book and puts them in the mouth of a completely imaginary Inca princess. But you get the same scathing criticisms of monarchy and hierarchy and rapaciousness. And she shows this to Turgot, who's a bit alarmed by it. You know, this is a bit dangerous, a bit subversive. He tries to get her to change the ending of the book so it becomes less subversive. She ignores him, publishes it. And over the next few years, Turgot publishes his own essays on world history, where he does something really, really interesting. He takes that indigenous critique and all these ideas about freedom, and he shoves them down to the bottom of a kind of ladder of evolution through which societies can develop. I mean, what he's saying here basically is that if these remote exotic peoples can have such freedoms, can have such equality, it's not because they're superior to us. It's actually because they're inferior to us. And what he means by that is inferior in their technological capacity and in their material wealth. And the basic point is that in order to progress up that scale of advancement towards modern industrial societies, you have to leave all that other stuff at the bottom. So Kandiyarank and everything he stood for, at best, in Turgot's scheme, at best can tell us about remote ages in the distant past of humanity. It's no longer a relevant critique to the way we organize our own lives and our own societies. So you see what he did there. And we're still thinking on those lines, you know, when anthropologists pluck an example here and there of a hunter-gatherer group, which is fiercely egalitarian, and they say, oh, this is what the original condition of humanity was like. There's still a lot of research on those lines, and it's very interesting research, but the basic procedure was invented by Turgot.
So he shoves a critique of hierarchy into a hierarchical
structure. Into a hierarchy, yeah. It's clever, isn't it?
Well, I mean, and it's also, I mean, there's got to be just implicit racism in this, right, as well?
Totally. It's totally racist. Yeah.
But, I mean, this is, I guess, a little bit an aside. I mean, as somebody who works in these academic fields, I mean, it's got to be more common than understood that a lot of these analyses or anthropological understandings of even modern cultures are so inherently in that very structure that you mentioned here.
Yeah, in the book, we call it the myth of the stupid savage. You know, we've all heard of the myth of the noble savage, but you don't really find that in Rousseau. You certainly don't find it in these 17th century missionary accounts. They're not romanticizing anybody. They're quite alarmed and disgusted by the sort of the wicked liberty of the savages, you know. What Rousseau does invent is this other kind of myth of people who, insofar as they are egalitarian or living happy lives, are doing it in this kind of weird parallel universe where, you know, they can't really think about what they're doing. They can't understand what are the consequences of their own actions. Oh, God, we've invented agriculture. Now we're trapped. We didn't see that coming. And the whole story that you get, and which you still get in some best-selling books about world history, is that our ancestors were just a bit dumb. And, of course, in the 19th century, this does get rationalized as eugenics and racism. And what's really interesting, there's a very important book by an anthropologist called Tara Ellingson, which is about where the idea of the noble savage really comes from. And it really comes from a clique of total racists who took over the British Ethnological Society in the Victorian period and who had figured out that if you want to dismiss the idea that Europeans actually may have learned something of moral value, of social value from native indigenous peoples, a very effective way of doing it is to actually say, oh, you're romanticizing. You're telling noble savage stories. It's really, it's more complicated, I think, than we realized when we got into it. But it's a fascinating story about how what looks like almost a post-colonial perspective, you know, stop romanticizing the other, stop romanticizing what's exotic, actually ends up doing the opposite and shutting down the possibility that you may have had cultural dialogue or cross-cultural influence. It's complicated, but it's also kind of familiar.
And so ultimately, it served it was almost, I guess, it was almost reverse engineered. How do we explain this contemporary alternative to the way that we're living? Well, we explain it because they're actually not as developed as we are. And right. So therefore it becomes less of a threat because time can't go backwards. We can't, we cannot return to the Garden of Eden, as it were.
Yeah, you end up with all those debates that we've all had a million times. Somebody says, well, if you want a more equal society, you're going to have to, you know, somehow undo the Industrial Revolution, get rid of mobile phones, get rid of all that technology, kill 95% of the people on the planet and go back to living in small groups like hunter-gatherers. I mean, you know, it's exactly the logic.
So, okay. So with the idea that as an intellectual, as in terms of like with having set, I guess the terms that the development of the idea of our development, may have been, less innocent in some respects, I guess, than we have all been led to believe. You go on to begin to present essentially physical evidence right. that undercuts the theory of our own development. Right. Like what are some of those key tentpoles? I mean, I know at one point mm-hmm. You talk about the difference between indigenous people in Northern California versus Canada. As it, but you tell me what you think are the most important sort of tent poles that begin to deconstruct the physical argument of our development.
That's a good example. We think it's an important one. It comes more out of anthropology than archaeology. Actually, we begin with more archaeological cases. So we take the evidence as far back as we feel we can. We don't want to get into that whole game of just speculating on the basis of no evidence. You know, the human species has been around, we think, for at least 200,000 years. And it's generally thought that for all of that period, cognitively, our brains were functioning more or less as they do now, which is kind of mind-blowing when you think that we actually have very little evidence for what was going on for most of that time. So we really begin our story where the evidence becomes rich enough, plentiful enough for us to actually begin to infer things about human social organization, which we think is roughly around the time of the last ice age, about 30,000 years ago. Now, according to the conventional wisdom, this is still long before agriculture. We should be expecting basically one form of hunter-gatherer society, probably a small egalitarian society, no private property, no classes or ranks. Is that what we see? Not at all. If we look at the archaeological record of Europe, not because there was anything particularly special about Europe, it's just that European countries are very wealthy and they've been doing archaeology for a long time, so we know more about it. What we see, among other things, are these burials, which are really fascinating. And we get them all over the continent, all the way from Russia over to France and the Dordogne. Burials of individuals who look like they're buried like kings and queens. They've got all this personal wealth, this jewelry hanging off them, thousands of ornaments and beads, big ceremonial weapons and regalia. So what are they doing there in a period where we're supposed to have egalitarian hunter-gatherers? And there are even more interesting things about them. For example, we know from the physical remains of their skeletons that a weird percentage, something like 70% of them, were people who today would be classed as disabled or as having, you know, very obvious physical features that differentiate them. They're either very tall, very short, congenital deformities, this kind of thing, like a non-random percentage of these rich burials. And then you realize also that there's nothing else apart from the burials to suggest that this is a heavily ranked hierarchical society. So it's like the kings and queens only exist in the burial, in the funeral, in the ritual. So immediately you've got something way more complicated going on. You've got a society that performs a kind of ceremonial pageant of aristocracy or inequality or class in certain contexts, perhaps at certain times of year. I mean, we're talking about Ice Age societies living on the tundra, you know, on the edge of glaciers. These are very seasonal environments. You have seasonal migrations of woolly mammoth and deer and horses and other animals. So these are societies that we argue were actually morphing. They were switching around their structures, often within the same year, often from hierarchical to egalitarian. And there are lots of examples of this in the anthropological literature of hunter-gatherer societies. From the circumpolar region, from the Canadian northwest coast, they would actually flip their whole political structure around and their legal system and even their religious system once or twice a year. They would almost just become a totally different society. And it often went together with people coming together in large groups and then dispersing. And you suddenly realize, well, it's the opposite of our conventional story, where there's meant to be this baseline form of humanity which is fixed and stable, and then comes agriculture and changes all that so it can never work the same again. Well, no, what we find are actually very experimental societies that are already trying things on for size. You know, they're trying out inequality, class, probably private property as well, but they're not getting fixed in any one system.
Is there I have two separate questions there. Is there What is it that necessarily means that if I happen to be someone that my clan or decides should be buried with all these ornate things, that is necessarily hierarchical, right? I mean, like, I don't know.
That's you look
at a basketball team and say, like, who's on the hierarchy here, the forward or the
You have a good point. Actually, we talk in the book about indigenous societies in California, which were hunter-gatherers, but they were not at all egalitarian in the sense that people imagine. Actually, they were very interested in money. Like many indigenous societies, they had their own forms of money. The men in particular used to accumulate large amounts of it, but it wasn't passed on through generations. So actually, when somebody died, they put all the wealth in the grave, so it looks like a rich, wealthy, but actually the effect was to level things out. So you had to take it with you. You couldn't pass it on to your kids. They had to make their own way in life and make their own reputations. Maybe that's what we're dealing with in the Ice Age. Very interesting possibility. But look, we're already talking about sophisticated people like us, people making decisions about what it means to have more wealth than somebody else and shaping their rituals, shaping their societies in accordance with that. We're not talking anymore about these kind of cardboard cutout cartoon characters that are usually presented as our ancestors.
Isn't there also an incentive for anthropological researchers, not like yourself, but some, some of the people we're looking at here, to center themselves as the evolved species and the society that has it figured out, and thus kind of othering their subjects as less so, because there's a narcissism there that might just be also like inherently human and needing to be made aware.
I often think of it the other way around, is that, the way we put people down is to pretend that they're not aware of their own problems and issues, that, they live in these kind of total social worlds where, they're almost automatically obeying customs and traditions and sort of unreflective, whereas we have all these existential crises and problems and we worry about things like gender and inequality, but they just live their lives according to a pattern. So it's weird. It's kind of reverse snobbery. Says because they've kind of got it all sorted out, they're primitive, whereas, we're advanced enough. And, this is partly what we try to show in the book. I mean, in a way, it's central, is that there's never been a time like that, when people weren't aware of exactly the same kind of deep paradoxes that we worry about all the time, mortality, inequality. It's just that they had a far greater range of often very creative ways of dealing with those than we give ourselves credit for, or than we do.
So just to go back on the idea that a clan, if you will, a group, could at different times of the year, it may be temporal, it may be just sort of like circumstantial, they come together with other groups and decide, we're going to, for the sake of facilitating this situation, create some form of hierarchy or some type of system, and then we're going to disband it because we don't want to impose this on ourselves over in a long period of time. But
we can imagine what it would be like to do that all the time.
Exactly. And we have a certain task to do, and it may be more suited for this task or this gathering than something else. There's another parallel to this that you discuss is the idea of like post-flood farming, agriculture. Yeah, I mean, talk about that, because that seems to be, again, a similar circumstance which would indicate that our ancestors had the ability to sort of say, like, this makes sense for now, but it doesn't necessarily make sense for later. And that's indicative of, or that cuts against this idea that there was sort of some type of like flow of development that they were just, passively following.
Yeah, I'm really happy you bring that up, because the great work on that was done by my former teacher in Oxford, a brilliant guy called Andrew Scherer, a prehistorian. He wrote about this phenomenon of floodwater farming, which is what a lot of the earliest Neolithic agriculture seems to have been like. It's almost the exact opposite of what Rousseau imagined. You know, he imagined that you've got land and somebody comes and stakes out a fence, and then you've got a field, and in the field you plant your crops, and that's it. It's your land, your property. Actually, a lot of early Neolithic farming took the form of going to the edge of a river or a lake, which flooded seasonally, like the Nile used to do until they built the Aswan High Dam. So you get the floods, and then the waters recede, and you've got a very naturally irrigated patch of soil, very fertile patch of soil. But of course, it's not the same every year. You know, the waters don't obey some kind of strict law of territoriality. Same bit of land may be flooded one year, maybe swamp the next year, maybe dry the next year. So you could put a fence around it, but it wouldn't do very much good. Come back the next. Here's my farming land. It is dry. And the other thing about it is that it's kind of sloppy farming. You know, you don't need to actually prepare the land. Yuval Harari, in his book *Sapiens*, talks about how farming trapped us. And the wheat, you know, growing the wheat meant that we had to labor in the fields and we had to bring the water to the fields. No, we didn't have to bring the water. If you know about prehistory, you know that's not how it worked at all. The water was there and nature was actually doing a lot of the toil. So it's a rather sort of lazy form of cereal agriculture, which means you can combine it with other things. So a lot of these early farming societies were not just farming, they were also hunting, fishing, foraging a whole range of wild plant resources. They were very diverse in their economic pursuits, which is very different from saying that there was an agricultural revolution where we went from being hunter-gatherers to something else.
And you also write about a pre-agricultural settlements that existed in Japan and had a certain amount of complexity. Talk about that. And then, you know, I want to start to like talk about the implications of these, what would otherwise be, I mean, that are supposedly anomalous to the story that we've been told. But in fact,
Japan, before the coming of rice farming, had a hunter-gatherer civilization called the Jomon, which lasted for over 10,000 years. A lot of things happened in those 10,000 years. You have phases with monuments that go up. These are societies that relied for food on mainly fishing and nut gathering. You have phases with rich aristocratic burials. There's a famous, if you're Japanese, it's famous heritage site called Sane Maruyama, which was a kind of hunter-gatherer center, almost a hunter-gatherer city with big storage buildings where they'd store up all their nuts and acorns. Very, very remote from the idea of a simple egalitarian society. They probably had more egalitarian phases. They also seem to have used cannabis, interestingly, not just for rope, but also to smoke. So, you know, this is a rich and fascinating, and they produced a pottery style, which is apparently also the basis for the graphics on the Nintendo game, Zelda. It was a famous video game, they tell me. And it's got these kind of rope design graphics, which the designer took from the Jomon pottery. So the Jomon actually have a digital afterlife.
So, I mean, if we take the aggregate of these sort of, I guess, physical refutations of the way of the story of how we developed, like, what does that mean? I mean, have we created?
I mean, tell you what it means to me.
Well, yes. I mean, what does that mean to you? I mean, we have been told, and to find out that it's not the case, what are the implications of that? I guess.
Yeah, I think a lot of this comes down to the, the function of the other story, the conventional story. The famous French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss had a theory about myths and why certain myths persist, which was really about the functions they fulfill in society. So what a myth really does is it takes a paradox, something we can't resolve. And just by telling the story, it kind of tries to mediate between these things. So man is born free, but everywhere we find him in chains. Let's tell a story about why that is necessarily the case. And what we say in the book is that the conventional telling of human history, apart from being factually wrong and frankly just a bit boring after 300 years, is also politically quite dismal, because it tells us that as human societies grow in size and complexity, radical inequality is inevitable. We might tweak and adjust it a little bit, but it's what we have because it's what we have, and there's no way out. And if you keep telling yourself those kind of stories and teaching your kids those kind of stories in school, that's not without consequence. So what it means to puncture that myth is A, that we can get closer to the evidence, we can get closer to an accurate scientific understanding of our species' past, but also B, we can reevaluate our capacities as human beings. What does it mean to be a human being? This is the basic question of anthropology. And what the evidence tells us now is that there's a whole set of possibilities out there that were way beyond the philosophies of Rousseau and Hobbes, and probably also beyond most of our philosophies.
And so if ultimately the way that we've organized societies today was a choice that was not inevitability because of the nature of human beings, what, and maybe, you know, I know that you and Graeber had intended to write a couple more volumes. But why did we make these choices? I mean, what was...
Yeah, this is the how we got stuck question, which we go into in the book. But I've realized as I talk to more people about it, this is what a lot of readers want to hear more of. So I'll try to give an indication without completely spoiling the book if people haven't read it. But insofar as we answer that question, it's about what we're left with when you strip away the old story about, oh, agriculture created inequality, living in cities created inequality. No, we show empirically that this is simply not the case. So what we're left with, as you say, is people making choices. And the question is why some of those choices did lead to patriarchy, to really, you know, extreme forms of structural inequality. We identify a couple of things. First of all, that the answers lie on the small scale of human interaction. It's not about populations scaling up. It's about what goes on in families, what goes on in households. And we give a whole series of examples in the book from a whole different range of societies about how inequality really begins from the bottom up. You know, you may have these big social movements and big political organizations, but ultimately they only really become stable and durable when people take them into their hearts and into their minds and internalize them in their gender relations, in the way that young people relate to old people and vice versa, domestic servitude, these kinds of things. And we also talk about violence and warfare. I've read some slightly, well, very misleading reviews of the book that claim that we romanticize the past. Not at all. We talk about prehistoric societies and indigenous societies that enslaved each other, that had extreme forms of violence and warfare. We also talk about societies that did the opposite. There's no romanticizing going on there. But what we try to understand is why sometimes that violence, even warfare, becomes structural. In other words, you know, you can have violence which is traumatic at the time, but it doesn't fundamentally alter the structure of society. Why is it that some forms of violence get into our homes? You know, they get into our entire mode of thought. And what we suggest in the book, in the various parts of the book, and more clearly in the conclusion, is that this happens when you get a kind of mixture, confusion of violence and the opposite, of systems of violence and what we call systems of care, or even systems of love. It sounds odd, but these are quite difficult questions to answer. So I'll give you an example. In ancient Egypt, which is an area that I've done quite a lot of research on the one hand, very violent, obviously very unequal society with Pharaoh at the top and a whole load of peasants and all the rest of it. But actually, these famous monuments that we've all seen, the pyramids, and pyramid temples, those are actually the result of everybody at certain times of year coming to care for the king. Everyone gets involved in feeding the royal ancestors, building monuments for the royal ancestors. So you get this kind of conflation of violence and its opposite. And we know this, I think, in our own societies. I mean, the love that people feel for their country can transform very easily into violence.
And is it just that, like, on some level, there is a societal advantage to violence and hierarchy, that in terms of, I'm trying to think of this like evolutionarily.
Interesting thing about these systems of hierarchy is that they're not inevitable. I mean, once they exist, we also show examples of people dismantling them. And I think that suggests that perhaps we are more on the right track here, because if we're not talking anymore about great historical forces crashing around over people's heads and we're all just victims, you know, adapting to the environment or something, if we're talking about choices, then it should be possible for people to unravel those choices, which is actually what Rousseau felt. He wasn't really a fatalist. He just said it wasn't going to be easy. But if we go back to Egypt, there are periods when people stop building great royal monuments. They're called the intermediate periods, when the whole thing becomes a lot less centralized. We talk about the ancient city of Teotihuacan in central, in the Valley of Mexico, where people start off with ritual sacrifice and, again, building great pyramids and monuments and temples. And then they change it all around after a couple of centuries and put all of their resources into housing and putting everyone up in really fabulous apartments. And you get a very nice living standard that would be the envy of any modern city. So these are relationships of hierarchy that are very durable, are very powerful, but people have actually succeeded in walking away from them or reversing them.
There's evidence. I mean, obviously, you're talking about it, but do you think that there is, that it requires more effort? I don't know how else to really sort of like explain it. Like, more effort because of certain elements of I don't know if it's human nature or context, but more effort to dismantle or to veer away from those type of things than it does.
I think it's, you know, this is an element of I've also seen people describe the book as anti-Marxist, but you know, if there's one insight I would take from Marx, is that this is about self-consciousness. In the way that my late co-author David wrote about debt, you know, he had this point that the reason that debt works, but you know, the reason that people feel obliged to pay their debts is because they've internalized it as guilt. They know at the end of the day that they're going to be forced to do it, that there's a stick. But it very rarely actually gets to that point, because people feel guilty. They've internalized it as their fault, their problem, something they have to, you know, not a system that was imposed on them. Although we know that's historically what happened. Higher education, for example, people feel it's their responsibility. And our argument about hierarchy is rather similar, not coincidentally, because I wrote it with David, but the logic is quite similar. So I think, escaping it is partly a matter of becoming conscious of it, asking better questions about where it comes from, the micro relationships, how we produce domination every day. There was a French writer long before Rousseau called Étienne de la Boétie, who wrote a book on what he called voluntary servitude. It's about people who like domination, who actually like not just to dominate others, but to be dominated, which, you know, in our minds probably conjures up, dungeons and dominatrices and that kind of thing. But it's also part of our society. There's no getting away from it. We have to create these hierarchies somehow every day, but that's not how we usually think about it. We tend to think they're there because of thousands of years, if we think about it at all. We think, and if we pick up a book on it, we're told, no, the reason they're there is because of ancient Egypt. You know, it started thousands of years ago and because of the origins of farming and that sort of thing. So that's the kind of almost psychological damage or collateral damage of the conventional telling of history that we're challenging and that we're trying to undo.
Is it possible that that just all comes down to a certain amount of dumb luck, like Rousseau and Hobbes were in the right time at the right place and they were defending a certain regime? I mean, I the only analogy within the context of our sort of more banal and recent politics is when it came to, you know, we have a gerrymandering problem in this country right now that is almost qualitatively different because of the quantity of it. And it was just a function of Republicans won in a year where the technology was such for the first time to go, and just dumb luck on some level, maybe some
dumb level. But, you know, again, maybe we can learn something from Kandiyarank and his folk who were really intrigued by the fact that European settlers could turn wealth into power. We just assume that's the case, that having more stuff than somebody else gives you the right to boss them around, make them work for you, whatever it may be. It's the mystery of capitalism in a way. It's what Karl Marx was trying to figure out. What is this magical process by which just having more stuff than somebody else gets transformed into power? And this principle was actually quite alien to them. They weren't egalitarian in the sense that they shared everything out equally in some obsessive way, because it just didn't matter that much. It's not as if you could convert it into any sort of coercive power. So when we talk about corruption, you know, I think I'd hesitate to say that the technology is the driving factor here. There's a pre-existing nexus of relationships there into which the technology, you know, drops as a sort of slightly random factor.
David Wengrau, the book is The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, which you wrote with David Graeber. Thank you so much. Fascinating. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Really appreciate your time today.
Enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. In just a moment, we're going to welcome
Nomi
will be coming.
I will be right back.
Emma will be right back. In the meantime, I will remind you, Majority Live. Come and see the show live. As of now, H. John Benjamin will be in attendance, as will Larry Murphy. I don't know what Larry's middle name is. You can get your tickets at majoritylive.com. January 16th, the big live. Also, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, you get extra content, and you keep us independent. Doesn't matter. Yeah, yesterday we celebrated Mike Cernovich Day, and it was really actually a day late, but It was our members that basically gave us the ability to address that whole situation and make sure that he was not the one who was laughing now. Damn. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian universe?
Yeah, tomorrow night, Left Reckoning returns with Paul Prescott. He is a Jacobin contributor, but also a Philly school teacher who's running for Philadelphia's 8th Senate District. We're going to have him on to talk about education, all the stuff that's attacks on teachers, and his run for state office, and more. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. That's tomorrow night at 8 Eastern, 7 Central.
Nomi!
What's up? Happy Thanksgiving, happy birthday, happy all the things, Sam. And Cernovich Day. All these holidays in one weekend. How can you handle it?
It's pretty crazy. Well, the Cernovich The only reason why I remember Mike Cernovich Day is because it was supposed to be held on my birthday. That was the day he did it. I don't know if they ever, I always wondered this. If I ever had one question to ask Mike Cernovich, it would be, did you realize it was my birthday that day? Like, I don't know if he did that on purpose. That would have been...
If they were being that thoughtful?
Yeah. I mean, that would have been...
Yeah,
not a big gift.
That would have been smart to do.
It would have been, yeah.
Presumably, most people are out doing something on their birthday. He did not realize that on that day, all I was doing was basically the same thing I always do, which is like, you know, just having Chinese food. I was talking to...
Ready for this.
I was talking to John Benjamin, who happened to be there that night. And... We talked about it when we had dinner for my birthday this year, which was I needed 20 minutes to write something up at the time, blah, blah, blah. You were busy last night.
I was busy a few nights ago. We pre-taped.
Oh, you pre-taped. All right.
Well, yeah, they don't do live. I think there's some shows are able to do live and some are not there yet, I think, for many reasons, but...
Okay. Well, we are we're going to play a couple of clips from your conversation with Dan DeBonganino.
Angino. I almost called him that.
But in the meantime, what's happening on your show?
Our show has a little bit more thought, I think, to it. But tonight we have the one and only Harvey Kays on for his monthly stop by on Rockfin and YouTube at 8 p.m. It's our TNS Live. So this is like a full longer conversation where we delve in deep on a couple issues with our guests. And then tomorrow, Wednesday, we have Melanie DiRigo, who was 2 years ago, she was a matriarch candidate and is a matriarch candidate. And she ran against Tom Suozzi, who is one of the worst Democratic members of Congress, who has announced yesterday that he's running for governor. Many think he's going to chip into Kathy Hochul, creating a whole other scenario. But he is a congressman from Long Island and parts of Queens, and she scared the crap out of him last run. And, you know, we don't know how the district's going to line up. Redistricting, you know, probably won't be announced till beginning of February, but she is an extraordinary candidate and she, like, it was just such a joy to work with, and we're going to have her on tomorrow. So regardless, you know, you should support her if you can.
So does Suozzi think he's going to win, or is he going to keep his seat in
stepping down from his seat? That's it. It's an open seat now.
What is he doing? Or is this just like an exit strat? Like, I don't understand.
You know, sometimes the simplest answer is just called narcissism.
All right. Well, good.
I think that's kind of what he's known for. He has a little bit of the strain of the political narcissistic tendencies. It's a certain type of narcissism. I think anybody who runs for office is a little bit full of themselves. Anybody who's in this media space has a little bit of that in them. And then there's, I mean, Sam, come on. Then there's that, like Cuomo, Trump, Suozzi, I think is like on that spectrum.
But I think in this instance, it seems to me an overestimation of his appeal. But I mean, I guess who knows?
People don't know who he is now, but listen, you have a crowded field.
Yep. I guess
you raise the money.
All right. Well, with that said, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. I'm not sure that we're going to take phone calls today. We'll see, but we will definitely take your IMs. You can get the app at majorityapp.com. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27, 1 half, 5 eighths, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.